Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for April 27th, 2012.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
What we were able to do is basically train the computer to tell the difference between what we tell it is a pixel of emperor penguin versus a pixel of guano versus a pixel of ice.
Not only can these planets get ejected, but on certain circumstances, they can get ejected at tremendous velocities, approaching 30 million miles an hour.
We decided to use a core sampling harpoon because on a comet, there's so little gravity that a drill or a shovel or a scoop, you'd push yourself right off the surface.
This week, could a harpoon catch a comet? And why some planets are on the run? But first, Suzanne Bard reports that scientists have been busy counting penguins from space.
The emperor penguin is Antarctica's most iconic animal, yet until now, no one really knew how many of the flightless birds live there. Scientists from a consortium of research institutions have teamed up to better estimate their numbers using satellite images. Ecologist Michelle LaRue of the Polar Geospatial Center at the University of Minnesota explains.
On the satellite images, when you zoom in far enough, you can see these little black specks sitting on the ice, and those little black specks are the emperor penguins. When you're looking at the satellite image as a whole, what you'll see is a bunch of white, you know, it's a bunch of ice, and you'll see a little brown smudge that represents their guano. But when you zoom in far enough to that brown smudge, you'll see a bunch of little black dots around the smudge and hanging out on the smudge. And those little black dots are the emperor penguins. What we were able to do is basically train the computer to tell the difference between what we tell it is a pixel of emperor penguin versus a pixel of guano versus a pixel of ice.
The new satellite-based analysis estimates the population at around 600,000 birds, nearly twice the number counted in previous ground-based surveys.
Antarctica is a continent. It's very harsh. It's remote. It's a very dangerous place. And so to be able to have a snapshot in time of what's going on throughout the entire continent as far as emperor penguins, other species, it's a really, really important tool. And so now we know that we can use satellite imagery to do those kinds of things.
LaRue says the technique could be used to estimate other animal populations on the world's most remote and inhospitable continent. She adds that having an accurate count will allow researchers to track the animal's response to climate change. Next, comets are left over from the early formation of our solar system. NASA scientists are building an apparatus that could harpoon a comet and bring back samples. Bob recently took a field trip to NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland and filed this report.
In an unfinished work area in a concrete office building at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, cryomechanical engineer Donald Weigel enters a makeshift office containing a desk, a computer, and a six-foot-high crossbow pointing down toward a 55-gallon trash can full of sand.
This is a ballista, which is really just a large crossbow and made out of two truck leaf springs. It pulls about 1,100 pounds of force at full pull, and it shoots these projectiles at about 100 feet per second or 30 meters per second, depending on the mass and obviously how hard you pull it back.
Do you just roll up your sleeves and climb up there? And
so we have mounted a four-wheeler winch at the top, and it is connected to sort of a trigger block, and that acts like your hand would on the bow. So the trigger block has sort of a set of fingers that grab the bowstring, which is a half-inch stainless steel cable. And then there is a linear actuator that is remotely operated that allows you to basically release your fingers outside the room from a safe distance and fire your harpoon.
The harpoon is a 12-inch projectile with a square cross-section and pointed end. It's hollow like a square gun barrel.
Load the projectile in, slide a shear pin in. And so the shear pin, you want to be just strong enough to hold the weight of it, but not strong enough to disturb its flight.
So that's a little piece of wood?
It's a piece of birch dowel.
Wow.
Now we're locked and loaded, and we'll leave the room and pull the safety door shut.
And then he gives me the honor of hitting the button to fire the bow. So why is NASA interested in firing harpoons? Well, Weigel explains the goal is to collect a sample from the subsurface of a comet and bring it home.
So traditionally, when you get a sample from something, you might use a shovel or a coring drill or a scoop. And in this case, we've decided to use a core sampling harpoon because on a comet, there's so little gravity that a drill or a shovel or a scoop, you'd push yourself right off the surface. So in concept, people use harpoons to hold on, and then they use their scoop or shovel. And the scientist I'm working with, Joseph Knuth, thought, why not get rid of the harpoon and shovel and combine it so you have a sample-collecting harpoon?
Okay. And the goal is to actually get something and then bring it back to Earth?
Yeah. So the biggest challenge and the key is to sample return. It's not an analysis when you get there and stay there and send the data back to Earth. We're actually collecting a sample and bringing it back to Earth. The advantages of that is that when you bring a sample back to Earth, you can study it for future generations. You can have terrestrial laboratories with much more sophisticated equipment. You may bring a sample back, and then in 50 years, something is invented to analyze that sample that was never even dreamed of. So it's a huge advantage to bring it back, although an enormous challenge.
Okay, and why sample a comet?
So comets are early remnants of the solar system's formation. And if you were to get a sample, you may find a lot of interesting ideas of how the solar system formed. And most importantly, you may find the origins of life on Earth. They're thought to have the building blocks that may have deposited life. So if you study them, you may find what I like to say the primordial ooze of the solar system.
Wow, go into that a little bit. So why would comets have that versus any other celestial object?
It's a good question. Comets haven't gone through the same processes that planets and stars have gone through, so they haven't experienced the intense heat and intense pressure and chemical change that has gone up on the planets. So all the ingredients were there at the beginning in the solar system's formation, but due to, again, this formation, the intense heat and pressure, all those components change in terms of planets and the sun. But comets, as I said, are just still floating around, early remnants, somewhat pristine, especially inside the comet. So that's our goal, is to shoot a harpoon into the subsurface, into the nucleus of the comet, get a sample, and you'll get the pristine material that perhaps has the origin of life.
So what goes into developing a harpoon to sample something that you've never been to before?
Yeah, it's funny. When I first started as an engineer, I wanted to know, what am I shooting at? And we really don't have an incredibly clear picture of exactly what we're shooting at. So the range of densities is really large. Basically, from cotton candy, these are like loosely coalesced bodies. So just granulars of ice and rock, barely held together, almost no gravity. So although it's made of rock and ice, which are dense, it's not held together very tightly. So the harpoon may, if you hit it, fly right through it. You have to design something that it may hit bedrock and it may hit something with almost no resistance. So it's a huge challenge.
I just got this image like in Wile E. Coyote or something where you're going to shoot the harpoon, it's going to go straight through the other side and then pull the spacecraft against a rock and smash it.
That's our goal, to avoid that. So we would spend a lot of time studying the comet when we get there. So a couple months trying to figure out, what is the density? What are the more interesting areas? You don't want to shoot straight into bedrock. Your harpoon's not going to go very deep. And you don't want to shoot into cotton candy. It's going to go too deep. So you study it for a while and decide your specific interesting location. And then you fire your harpoon, take a sample, make this oversimplified, but you put it in your return pod and you send it back to Earth.
Weigel says the actual mission will use one or more cannons instead of a ballista.
The main reason we use a ballista right now is because a cannon's not safe to fire in the lab, and we would take longer to fill out the paperwork to run the cannon than to do any experiments. So we've designed the ballista for safety reasons, but in terms of mass savings, the ballista itself is far too massive.
A key part of the apparatus is, of course, the harpoon itself, which must penetrate the comet, collect a sample, and then deliver the sample back to the spacecraft.
You've got a harpoon sheath, which basically takes the brunt of the explosive force of the cannon and the impact force. So it's got a sharp tip and a kind of robust back end. And then the sample cartridge itself is basically a cartridge that slides inside the harpoon sheath that has a garage door-like mechanism that kind of pulls a foil around the sample and captures it. So as the harpoon goes in, this fills with material, this door shuts, and this gets pulled back into the spacecraft by a tether. Gets pulled back into, specifically into a return capsule. It sort of looks like a clamshell After you've collected all your samples, you shut the shell and send it back home.
And this part stays in the comet?
Correct. So one of the nice things is the sheath stays in the comet, and so you've guaranteed that the hole you've dug is a little bit bigger than the thing you're pulling out. Because one of the concerns is, let's say you shoot a couple meters in, if that material collapses back around the hole, you're going to have a tough time getting it back out.
That would suck if it just went in and got stuck.
Yeah, and so we have a lot of the design that right now we're working on the tether dynamics. It's really a challenging problem to know. If it gets stuck and you yank on it, you don't want the harpoon flying back at the spacecraft. You don't want the sample cartridge kind of uncontrolled flight back towards the craft or any tangling.
You know, like take the whole comet back with you by mistake.
A lot of people think that's what we're doing, that when you hear harpooning a comet, you're going to drag her back home.
Weigel says the comet mission is probably a decade away, so they've got lots of time to work out any kinks. And he says since the work has begun, other missions have been interested in the harpoon system too.
We've proposed even using these harpoons not only for low gravity, but as a rapid sample retrieval. I mean, these things fire quickly, collect the sample, and get out of there. So you could think about, even on our moon, where you have long periods of night, you would have no power, depending on what your power source is. If it's solar, you need to get into your area, say a crater, get a sample, and get back out quickly. Same ideas on Titan. We've looked at one of Saturn's moons, using this to take samples from perhaps a balloon-borne carrier. So you'd have a balloon floating around, shooting harpoons down below and rapidly retrieving samples.
In the next few months, Weigel says his ballista will be leaving the lab to fire the harpoons in a more realistic setting from an outdoor tower.
It used to be a sort of a laser-ranging tower. Mm-hmm. Out at one of our remote sites. It's 20 feet tall with an empty platform now that we're going to lift the ballista up onto, and we're going to fire down the center of it so we can simulate free flight of the harpoons. Right now, they're only flying a couple feet. We want to shoot closer to 20 or 30 feet to simulate tether dynamics and how to keep the harpoon stable over that long distance.
The tests this summer reflect increased interest not only in the harpoon system itself, but also in sample return missions overall.
We started this conceptually probably 5 or 6 years ago, and there wasn't a huge push for sample return. And now it's really exciting to see that people are lining up and trying to support us.
Since its formation, our solar system has been running fairly smoothly, with all the planets rhythmically orbiting the Sun. But, as Science Update correspondent Justin Warner learned, planets elsewhere in the galaxy sometimes pop loose and hurtle into deep space.
Our Milky Way galaxy may occasionally hurl planets into deep space at breathtaking speeds. This according to Idan Ginsberg of Dartmouth College and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. In 2005, Smithsonian astronomers proved that this can happen to stars when two stars orbiting each other drift close to the center of the galaxy.
Where lies a supermassive black hole, and sometimes what can happen is the system gets disrupted, so to speak, so one star falls into orbit around the black hole. And so the system loses energy that way. But since energy has to be conserved, the other component, the other star, gains the energy. And sometimes it can gain enough energy to get kicked out of the galaxy.
Now, using computer simulations, Ginsberg's team has determined that planets orbiting such a star could meet a similar fate.
We ran thousands and thousands of simulations, and one of the things we saw is that not only can these planets get ejected, but on certain circumstances, they can get ejected at tremendous velocities, approaching 30 million miles an hour.
That's over 300 times as fast as the Earth orbits the Sun. For further proof, Ginsberg says runaway planets would have to be detected indirectly, at least with today's technology. It would be done in the same way we currently detect planets orbiting stars beyond the solar system, by measuring dips in brightness in the stars caused by the orbiting planets passing in front of them.
Thanks, Justin. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, how a monkey's social status can affect its genes, and why holding guns makes people seem larger. Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.